The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
It's not a mystery. They always tell you that question. They never tell you the answer. I went decades of my life. So what's the answer to this?
The award-winning physicist and science writer Sean Carroll will be letting you in on the secret of the universe. Yes, really. And...
So the tail or abdomen is pulled away from the rest of the body whilst the animal is alive, and the head end, the nervous system, will remain viable for at least an hour.
Professor Bob Elwood will be spoiling the joy of a crab sandwich when he discusses his research into the pain thresholds of this tasty crustacean. Also, I'll be joined by astronomy journalist Stuart Clark to discuss this week's announced EU-US collaboration in space. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. Let's kick off with that announcement this week that NASA and the European Space Agency have announced an intention to collaborate on a deep space mission. Joining me to tell me more is our astronomy blogger, Stuart Clark. Welcome to the podcast, Stuart.
Hi, Alok. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you're very welcome. Now, let's talk about this press conference that happened this week. It was very highly trailed, and then it turned out not to be too exciting in the end. We both watched it online. What is it about? This is a collaboration between the European Space Agency and NASA on the Orion project. Tell us what Orion is.
So Orion is the flagship American mission to take astronauts into deep space. So perhaps a return to the moon or to an asteroid, eventually, they say, to Mars. And it was an all-American deal until this week, pretty much. That's what we are being told now. At the European Space Agency's Ministerial Council meeting last year, that was when we first saw that there was an agreement for Europe to provide the service module for Orion. So that's everything on the spacecraft apart from the crew compartment. And the press conference this week was sort of NASA's turn to tell America that Orion was no longer a purely American mission. Now Europe was involved.
Why is that such a big deal? Why the sort of stage managed announcement and the sort of the prevarication around it?
I think perhaps this was a massive step for them because it puts into what they call the critical path somebody that isn't American, Europe. And for just ideologically, I think perhaps that's a big step to take.
And NASA's come to this party a little bit late on this idea of international collaborations. I mean, obviously the scientists that NASA on the robotic probes work with scientists all over the world on many of the sort of wonderful projects out there that we talk about all the time, Kepler and Hubble and all sorts. There's involvement from the Europeans. This is the first human space flight collaboration, and perhaps that's the reason that there's so much emotion around it. This is the successor to Apollo, essentially. Mm. And the capsule looks a bit like Apollo, like a modern, bigger version of Apollo. You mentioned it would go to the moon, perhaps even to Mars. These are going to be the big iconic missions for the next few decades, if they happen, fingers crossed. Let's talk a bit more about ESA's specific role. You say it's the propulsion systems, and it's based on the very successful automated transfer vehicle that's been servicing the International Space Station for the past year or so. Just tell us a bit about that and how the Europeans convinced NASA that it was a good idea to get into partnership.
Yes, so the ATV is part of this big international collaboration to maintain the International Space Station, and it's a space taxi, if you like, a cargo vehicle. And it, as you say, it's been highly successful. There was always talk within ESA of what to do once they stopped building these things to service the ISS, and should they use them to develop their own manned capsule, or should they use them to try and collaborate with NASA in a single global manned exploration endeavor?
Yeah, the ATV is completely robotic. It sends cargo supplies up to the space station and back. It's been very good.
Yes, but it's always been designed with an eye to the future as well, that it could be adapted and used elsewhere. So this announcement this week is really an extension of the ISS agreement. So instead of building another ATV for ISS, ESA will now build or modify its ATV to become the propulsion, the avionics, the communications and power system for the Orion crew capsule. The interesting thing for me here is that this is just for one mission. There's no guarantee that ATV will be the service module for future Orion missions.
Doesn't that make it more difficult, though, for ESA engineers, you know, in terms of thinking about the long term? I mean, they're not going to send their own crew capsule up, so they're going to spend a lot of time and effort building something that may... that doesn't necessarily have a future.
Yeah, this I think this for me, this is a high-risk game that's being played. And it seems as if ESA are hoping that by committing to this one, or getting NASA to commit to this one mission, they can prove that they are reliable partners, that they can do this, and that that will hopefully in future lead to providing the service module for other Orion missions. And hopefully, if that were the case, bargaining to have a European seat on those manned missions.
And that's the critical thing, isn't it? It's NASA has a history in human space flight that's second to none. And Europe can get a really significant role on that. And the exciting stuff, there's lots of exciting stuff to come. So what should we be looking out for? When are these missions going to go up? Who's going to be on them? And when will we know whether there's a European astronaut or not?
So there's going to be a test mission in 2014. What ESA will be contributing to is... the mission in 2017, and this will take the Orion capsule all the way around the moon. It will circumnavigate the moon and bring it back. Now, as part of the agreement, NASA will buy spare components for some of the service module in case they damage or break some. But in putting together the first mission, those spares can be used on the second mission. So ESA will have some level of hardware on the second mission. And the second mission is the one that's coming in around about 2021. And this is the one where there will be four astronauts on the mission. And at the moment, the sort of baseline mission is that they will orbit the moon for perhaps 3 or 4 days, and then they will come back to Earth. Now, that's been seen by some as being too cautious, and some people would like much more, the astronauts to do much more than that.
60 years after Apollo, or just under 60 years after Apollo, that's all they're going to do. Well, I say that as if I can do that myself. But
Well, this has been raised in public debate by the NASA Advisory Council that at the moment, this EM2, Exploration Mission 2, just has as a stated goal to demonstrate astronaut capabilities beyond Earth's orbit. But that was demonstrated, they say, decades ago. So there needs to be something more inspirational.
Well, we're just a lot more risk-averse nowadays, aren't we? And I suppose there's more opportunities to sort of spread the news if something goes wrong, whereas in the 60s they could at least keep a lid on those sorts of things. And they didn't know if anything was going to work. Everything did, and I think we're tricked into thinking that things just go perfectly first time, but because things worked so successfully during Apollo.
And during that time, I mean, there were disasters during that.
Indeed, Apollo 1, yeah.
But it was seen that the risks were deemed necessary because they were in the Cold War with Russia.
So overall, a good thing for ESA. I mean, is ESA in good shape? I mean, it's got all sorts of exciting things happening compared to NASA, What do you think?
I think ESA is in generally good shape. It has recovered very well and very robustly from NASA pulling out of a number of science missions. And it's pulled itself back together, got on with them. And this is a gamble for them. I think it's one that I dearly, dearly hope to see pay off. Because it could, as we said, get European astronauts into deep space.
Do you think that EM3, whenever that will happen, let's say 2025, might need an astronomy blogger on it? Blogging and tweeting live from the other side of the moon.
Yeah,
and you know where my next question is, don't you?
You're trying to get rid of me, aren't you?
No, I want reports from there.
You're trying to
the loneliest blog in the world.
The loneliest blogger in the world, yes.
What do you think?
What is it?
Put your flag down. I think you want to go, don't you?
I think what we're going to see between now and whenever EM3 is, I think we are going to see massive increases in the number of people going into space through space tourism, or at least having access to space, maybe even through telerobotic rovers on the moon or something like that. So we are in the middle of great change. And in the same way that young children take naturally to computers, I think in the future young people will just take naturally to space as a natural environment to think about, to work in even.
Stuart, thank you very much indeed.
Very welcome. Thank you.
To read all about the NASA-ESA joint project and to read more of Stuart's Across the Universe blog, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. A number of questions may come to mind when picking shellfish from a menu. Is it safe to eat? How is it sourced? But not many of us would think to ask, did it die a painful death? This week, new research into the question of crabs and pain was published by Professor Bob Elwood from the Queen's University in Belfast. For Science Weekly, Ryan O'Hare spoke to Professor Elwood.
My approach has been to ask with Crustacea, can I devise experiments which, if the results come out one way, it would say the data can be satisfactorily interpreted as a reflex, or if they come out another way, that they cannot be interpreted as a reflex, that they clearly involve central processing. So that's been my approach.
So what in your definition is pain, and how is it different to this reflex, this nociception that you speak of in your paper?
Pain is normally defined in terms of the unpleasant feeling.
Okay, and the reflex would be just automatically moving away from that.
That's right. The reflex is just a reflex. And indeed, there are some human beings with brain damage in specific areas who will move their hand away from a hot iron, and when you ask them, did that hurt, they will say, did what hurt? That is, they have no knowledge.
Okay.
Of having their move their hand.
And can I ask you about your study then, your study which was just recently published in the Journal of Experimental Biology. You were studying shore crabs. Can you just tell us what your study was about and how you went about it?
I wanted to find out whether these animals could learn to avoid a particular area and to discriminate between a safe area and an unsafe area. So shore crabs, you find them under rocks at low tide, and it's important that they hide under rocks at low tide, because if they come out, they'll get eaten by seagulls. So they show a very strong preference for being in dark hiding places, if you like, when it's light. So what I did was to provide an arena, an oblong arena, and at either end of the arena was a dark hiding place, sort of modelled loosely on the underside of a rock. And when we placed a crab in the middle of the arena, it would invariably run to one or other of those shelters. And for half of the crabs, we had decided beforehand that irrespective of which shelter it selected, we would deliver mild electric shocks whilst it remained in that shelter. The other crabs didn't get shocked. But in either case, the alternative shelter would get the alternative treatment. So after 2 minutes, we took the crabs out, rested them for about a minute, placed them back into the middle of the arena and said, now take your choice again. And the vast majority of crabs went back to the original shelter, the first one they'd selected. And that was irrespective of whether they'd been shocked or not. But when we did it a third time, those crabs had now had two experiences in this apparatus. Those that had been shocked on the second trial showed a big shift towards abandoning that, and they now chose the other shelter. Those that hadn't been shocked continued to use the shelter that they seemed to prefer. So it's quite clear that the animals were responding to the shock. They were switching shelters away from one they had originally preferred to the alternative shelter. So it was quite clear that over successive trials, the animals had learned an avoidance learning task, and they discriminated between the two shelters. and that had not been shown in previous work.
What's the importance of these findings? Why should we care if crabs can feel pain or not? What's the significance of these findings?
I suppose it's the same as asking, does any animal experience pain? Some people are concerned if cattle or pigs or poultry experience pain, and they say if we're going to eat these animals, then they want them treated in a humane way, both whilst they're alive and when they're killed. The problem with crustacea is that no acknowledgement of the possibility of them experiencing pain has really been given in the past. So they have quite extreme treatments given to them in some circumstances. And we are dealing with unimaginably vast numbers of animals in the world trade in crustacea. I mean, a number of billion, that is, a number of million and million, are used each year. Some of those, for example, some crab fisheries, the fisherman only has a market for the claws, so the claws are pulled off the animal, and the live animal is then thrown back into the sea, and the claws are retained by the fisherman. In other instances, prawns and lobsters, it's the tail end, what a zoologist would call the abdomen, is the part which contains the meat, and the head is not of much use to the food industry. So the tail or abdomen is pulled away from the rest of the body whilst the animal is alive, and the head end, the nervous system will remain viable for at least an hour after that treatment. And if you really want to see some extreme treatment, I recommend your readers or listeners to look at YouTube, look up eating live lobster, and you can see pictures of restaurants where live lobster is served and cut up for the customer, still wriggling, so that bits of the flesh can be taken out and eaten. Now, clearly, if these animals even have a slight probability of experiencing pain, I think these activities might be questioned.
How is this relevant in terms of cooking lobster? Should we change the way that we perhaps cook crab and lobster by boiling them?
A lot of crustacea are killed by boiling. If the animal is very small, such as a shrimp, boiling might be a very quick way of killing the animal. But when you start getting to larger animals, the brain, the nervous ganglia, are deeper within the animal, and there is a thick carapace, and it will take many seconds for the inside of the animal to heat up it sufficiently to denature the brain and to effectively kill the animal. I think you have to have a value judgment. Are you happy that an animal might take 10, 15 seconds to die in those circumstances in comparison with other techniques which might kill it instantaneously? I think if you were dealing with cattle and you said, oh, I quite like to kill cattle in a way that takes 15 seconds for them to die without stunning, that might be questioned.
So crabs are notoriously hard to work with. Did you have any escapees?
No, we're used to working with crabs in the lab, and you're quite right. They're very good at getting out of tanks. So my advice to anybody who is keeping shore crabs or crayfish or things like that in tanks is to keep a lid on the tank and to keep a rock on top of the lid, and then the crabs will not escape.
Thank you very much, Professor Elwood. Thank you.
Okay.
Ryan O'Hare there, talking to Professor Bob Elwood. To read Ryan's piece, go to guardian.co.uk/science. And remember, if you don't have time to read the entire Guardian, you can now listen to the Guardian audio edition.
This week on the Guardian audio edition, spies, Chopin, and a last-minute rescue in Libya. Cyclist Nicole Cook retires and speaks out. And our audio book review looks back at Raymond Chandler's career and Stuart Neville's Rat Lines. To subscribe for free, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology. He specializes in dark energy and general relativity. Until recently, he was also a contributor to the very famous physics blog Cosmic Variance. He's appeared on many TV shows in the US, including the Science Channel's Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman and also the Colbert Report. Sean was in London last week to talk about his new book at the Royal Institution. The book is about the Large Hadron Collider, the search for the Higgs boson, and the people who made it happen. In this extract from his lecture, Sean tells us why the discovery of the Higgs boson was inevitable at CERN.
Well, physicists knew this was coming. It was not a surprise. We've been looking for this particle for a long time. We had hints that we were getting close to it. Part of the result of these hints was that I wrote a book about the whole thing that you can buy right out there in the lobby. And so we weren't surprised, and yet we have done a very, very bad job of explaining why this discovery is so important. It's not that we haven't tried. Physicists have tried to come up with sort of clever labels and things to sort of impress upon a more general audience that this is a big deal. Some of those labels are frankly not a good idea. And we're regretful that we have invented those labels, and we've moved on from those. But we still haven't really quite nailed it. And I have a theory as to why we are not able to explain the Higgs boson very well. And the theory is that we use the wrong starting point. The kind of starting point we use to discuss particle physics is this guy. Does anyone know who this is a portrait of? Okay, you don't know, believe me. This is purportedly a portrait of Democritus. Democritus, an ancient Greek philosopher, 2,500 years ago. Essentially, Democritus was the first theoretical particle physicist. He was the guy who really pushed an idea that also his predecessor also pushed, but his predecessor didn't write anything and publish or perish in the academic world. So Democritus was the first to commit to print the idea that the world is made of atoms, as he called them, what we would now call elementary particles, because our 19th century forebears skipped ahead and called things atoms, even though they weren't truly elementary. But the Democritean idea is really so astonishing that we should step back and really appreciate what he was saying. You know, if you look around you, there's air, there's wood, there are desks, there's metal, there's cloth, there's other human beings. These substances appear very different, right? They have different properties. They look different. They react differently. And yet, Democritus says they're not fundamentally different. They're just different arrangements of the same underlying stuff called atoms. And that idea, it took a long time to get it right. It turns out to be right. And what we now, the descendant intellectually of Democritus' ideas are what we call particle physics. Now, of course, because he lived 2,500 years ago, there's no surviving image of what Democritus actually looked like. All there is a surviving nickname that he had, the Laughing Philosopher. So because that was his nickname, he was a very, very popular subject for portraiture in the Renaissance, because the portrait painter could just paint a self-portrait of himself laughing and then label it Democritus. So this is Rembrandt's self-portrait labeled Democritus. We have no idea what Democritus looks like, but we give him credit for launching the bandwagon we currently know as particle physics. The problem is that particle physics as an idea is not the right way to think about the Higgs boson, and that's the stumbling block that we're all faced with. So rather than go back to Democritus, I like to talk about the Higgs boson by referring to these guys, a younger generation of important thinkers. These are Americans. You might not be familiar with the phenomenon, as we might say. This is the Insane Clown Posse. These two young gentlemen, this is Violent J, and that's Shaggy 2 Dope. These are not the names that their mothers gave them, but they're artists. And this is a thing in the United States. These guys paint their faces, and they have followers called Juggaloos who have big events, and they're rappers. They're musicians. So a couple of years ago, they shocked the world by, you know, most of their songs involve rather outre activities, violence, you know, they're partying. That's what they do. So a couple of years ago, they shocked the world by having a reflective tune about the miracles of the world all around them. The tune was called Miracles, and if you read it, they say, "I see miracles all around me. Stop and look around. It's all astounding. Water, fire, air, and dirt. Frickin' magnets. How do they work?" Frickin' was not the word, but you can Google it. You can look it up.
Now, the boys received a certain amount of disapprobation from the scientific community by saying, magnets, how do they work? We know how magnets work. Much of it was demonstrated right here, where I'm standing, many, many years ago. So we do have a working scientific understanding of the esoteric phenomenon known as the magnet. But I nevertheless want to give them a little bit of credit, because even though we understand it, even though we have equations we can attach to this idea, it is still astounding. Think about a magnet. A magnet is something you can attach to a piece of metal, right? It will stick to it, a refrigerator or so forth. You can stick lots of things to lots of other things. You can stick pieces of tape or gum or whatever. But when you stick a piece of tape to the refrigerator, the tape has to touch the refrigerator in order to stick. The gum has to touch the refrigerator in order to stick. A little insect or gecko walking up the wall needs to touch the thing in order to stick to it. A magnet, if you hold it close to a piece of metal, you can feel it pulling before it touches. The magnet reaches across empty space and exerts a force, and the refrigerator exerts a force back, according to Sir Isaac Newton, that pulls the two things together. They don't need to touch each other. How is that possible? How does the magnet know that there is a refrigerator nearby that it should be attracted to? So the answer, well, I'll tell you the answer, but first I'll tell you that it's not just these modern-day philosophers who are puzzled by this. There's an older natural philosopher who is puzzled by this. We've already given him a name. Sir Isaac Newton was very puzzled by this phenomenon, which is known as action at a distance. Newton was interested in gravity, not magnetism, but it's the same thing. The Earth exerts a force on the moon or satellites orbiting the Earth. They're not touching each other. The Earth seems to push out across empty space to exert this force on things in its vicinity. Newton said that you can understand gravity throughout the universe in terms of an inverse square law. The force of gravity becomes weaker and weaker as you move away, as the distance between the two objects squared, okay? So, but he was very worried. In fact, he said that this phenomenon of action at a distance made no sense, even though it was part of his theory. To Newton, the action at a distance aspect of his extremely successful theory of gravitation was much like contemporary physicists think about quantum mechanics. An incredibly successful phenomenology, a set of rules that fits the data to wonderful precision, and yet deep down in our bones, we think it makes no sense. We can't quite make sense of it. And Newton's problem with action at a distance was actually solved by another philosopher slash scientist, Pierre-Simon Laplace. Laplace came up with a new theory of gravity. It turns out it wasn't really a new theory of gravity. It was the same theory as Newton's. No one talks about Laplace's theory of gravity. It's a way of rewriting Newtonian gravity, but it's a way that gets rid of the action at a distance. What Laplace says is that instead of just thinking about, you know, random forces between objects very, very far away, imagine there is a field filling the universe. And what that means mathematically is just that at every point in space, there's a number. The number, the value of the field. Just like the temperature of the air in this room, at every point there's a value, the temperature at that point of the air. But this is not some phenomenology of the matter. This is just a fundamental feature of reality, the gravitational potential field. And the way it works is that near the Earth, here's the Earth, and it's this curve is the value of the gravitational potential field. It's pushed down by the Earth, then it just climbs up smoothly, and the gravitational force that an object feels is just the slope of that line, the amount by which, the rate at which, the gravitational potential field is changing. So there isn't anything acting instantaneously and spookily at a distance. There's a smooth change from the position of the Earth to the position of the Moon. The gravitational potential is very low here near the Earth, and it climbs upward as you go toward the Moon, and that change keeps going forever. So the Earth is affecting something that stretches throughout the entire universe, the gravitational potential field. There's nothing acting instantaneously across a very large distance. And this idea of a field turns out to be quite useful. It wasn't just Laplace. In fact, in the minds of physicists, the person whose name is most closely attached to the field concept is Michael Faraday, who gave the lectures right here in this very spot. He said that the way to think about electricity is in terms of the electric field. And that's what we do these days. We talk both about particles and about fields. In one sense, a particle and a field are the opposite of each other, right? A particle is something that has one location. Here's the particle. It's nowhere else. A field is the opposite of that. A field is everywhere. At every point in space, there is a value of the field. So if you look at the picture up here on the left, these are tracks of particles through a cloud chamber. They're individual lines. A particle moves through the chamber and leaves a little trail behind. They're curving because they're moving in a magnetic field. On the picture on the right, there is a magnet. You can't see the field lines directly, but they're traced out by the little iron filings that are in the vicinity of the magnet. So you can visualize the fact that around this magnet, there's an invisible field filling space. So particles and fields are the two things that physicists talk about when we talk about the ingredients that make up reality. And if you have a tiny bit of physics education, you may have come up against the question, is light, for example, a particle or a wave? A wave is sort of a vibration in a field. So what is more important? Is it the particle aspect of reality or is it the field aspect of reality? It's fields. That's the answer. It's not a mystery. They always tell you that question. They never tell you the answer. I went decades of my life. So what's the answer to this? This is the answer. It's fields. Any questions about that? So I'm going to go into a little bit more detail, but not too much. But this is the crucial slide, okay? There's no more information. There's nothing more to come on this slide. The reason why the Higgs boson as a concept is hard to grasp is because you need to stop thinking of the world in terms of particles. You need to start thinking of it in terms of fields. And you say to yourself, well, but things like this table are made of atoms, and atoms have electrons and so forth in them, and the electrons are particles, right? There are particles in the world. No, there aren't. That's the secret that we physicists have never told you, but here I am, I'm going to tell you right now. The reason why you're allowed to think of particles is because of quantum mechanics. The world is made of fields, but quantum mechanics says when you look at the world, you don't see it directly. What really exists, according to quantum mechanics, is immensely richer than the things we can actually observe. So the reason you think that there are particles is because there are actually all these fields filling empty space. At every point in space, there's dozens of little vibrating fields in front of you. But quantum mechanics says that when you look at the fields closely enough, they resolve into individual particles. So on the picture on the right here is from David Deutsch, an Oxford physicist, one of the founders of quantum computation theory. And he says, imagine you are a frog. He doesn't care whether you're a frog or not, but frogs, it turns out, have slightly better vision than human beings do. And what that means is that frogs can see individual particles of light, photons. You're all seeing light from the light bulbs here, from the screen and so forth. Light is two things, right? Light is a wave in the electromagnetic field. So there's a field filling space at every point here. There's a little electric field, a little magnetic field. They're vibrating, and that's the light that is coming to you. But quantum mechanics says you look at that light very carefully, it turns into individual particles called photons. Photons are the particles that you see when you look at a wave in the electromagnetic field. So if you think a light bulb or a lantern and someone is moving it away from you on a dark night, it gets dimmer and dimmer as it goes out in the distance. And to you, it just fades away. But if your vision were better, if you were as good as a frog at looking at things, it would stop getting dimmer and start flickering. So there's a point below which the brightness never goes. It just becomes more intermittent. And what's happening is you're making a transition from seeing lots of photons all at once to seeing individual photons hitting your eye. The reason why light resolves into photons is because quantum mechanics says that when you look at it, that's what you see. The relationship between particles and fields is that fields are what the world is made of, particles are what you see. So the atoms in this table, the electrons, the quarks, the protons, these are all vibrations in fields. There's a quark field that is vibrating. You look at it, you see quarks. There's an electron field that is vibrating. There's a neutrino field that is vibrating. There's a gravitational field that is vibrating, and so on and so on. That's quantum field theory. It is the very heart, the central organizing concept of modern physics. And no one tells you until you buy my book. All right. But even when there's no particles around, there's still the Higgs field. It's everywhere you go. You personally move through Higgs field as you travel through the day. And that's crucially important to how your personal physics works, because all of the particles that you're made up of interact with this Higgs field. The weak nuclear force is attenuated because of the Higgs field, but also the other particles that you're made up of get heavier because of the Higgs field. So if there were no Higgs field, turns out this is a whole long story that most of us just don't want to talk about, so we just talk faster and faster, which is exactly what I'm going to do. Turns out, if you try to make a sensible theory of the weak interactions, you predict that not only is the weak interactions mediated by a massless particle, but the electron is massless. The up quark is massless. All the quarks, all the leptons are exactly massless if the weak interactions make sense if you don't have a Higgs field. We know that's not right. We know that the electron has a mass. Without the Higgs, the electron would zoom around at the speed of light. Why would you personally care about that? Because if the electron were moving around at the speed of light, it would not settle into atoms. Okay? If there was no Higgs field filling empty space, there wouldn't be atoms. There'd be electrons and quarks and so forth, but the electrons would be zipping around like photons at the speed of light everywhere in the universe. They would not settle down, make an atom. There'd be no atomic physics. Therefore, there would be no chemistry. There'd be no possibility for two atoms to get together. Therefore, there would be no... I know you don't like chemistry, but it's important to you. Because without chemistry, there is no biology. Without biology, there is no life. There are no lectures at the Royal Institution and so forth. Without the Higgs field, life as we know it would be utterly impossible. It would be essentially... no one knows of a way that you could even get any interesting complex structure in the universe if it weren't for the Higgs field. But you put a Higgs field there in empty space... Now that electron is moving through this thick, treacly-like Higgs field, and it picks up a mass thereby. Instead of zipping along at the speed of light, now the electron keeps talking to the Higgs field all around it, and it gets some heft because of that. It has a mass. It takes effort to get it moving. The electron can now settle down. We can have atoms. We can have chemistry. We can have life. You're getting an idea of why this notion of the Higgs field filling empty space is so important to physicists, important enough that we built giant machines to go look for it. So just to summarize where we are, the reason why the Higgs field is interesting is because it's based on a field that is not zero in empty space, a purely theoretical construct from 1964 meant to address the question, why are the weak interactions so short range? And ever since 1964, we've been looking for the thing. But it's also not the end of the road. We've been very, very excited by discovering the Higgs boson. I mean, this is literally, the idea of the Higgs boson came here on Earth before I did. I have never been alive at a time when we didn't know about the idea of the Higgs boson. That's how long we've been looking for it. That's why Peter Higgs got a little misty at the seminars at CERN when it was discovered that they actually found it. I mean, here's a young guy, right, you know, graduate student, postdoc kind of level, and everyone doing this at the time was very young. And they were puzzling with this problem, why are the nuclear forces short range? And they came up with this idea, and they wrote it down, and everyone ignored them. And then over 40 years later, someone says, oh yeah, here it is. We paid $9 billion and we found it. That's just science at its absolute working best. But we're not done. The Large Hadron Collider was not built just to find the Higgs boson. It was built to find new particles. We are also trying to create dark matter or other particles associated with the dark matter at the LHC. So it's absolutely clear, not just a wishful thinking kind of thing, that there must be new physics out there. The LHC is on the mark to try to search for it. We'll have to see if nature is kind or a little malicious to us. In the meantime, if you don't tune your telescope on the rest of the universe, if you stay in this room and you think about your life, as long as you're not a professional physicist or astronomer, if you think about the physics, the laws of physics underlying the phenomena that you experience every day, so the table, the chair, the sun shining, you and me, rabbits and bunnies and trees and grasses and bugs and so forth, these are all made of particles described by the Standard Model of Particle Physics. There are no new particles you need to describe bunny rabbits. I can guarantee that, because if there were, quantum field theory says we could make them at the LHC, and we would have made them a long time ago. As long as quantum field theory is right within the regime of a bunny rabbit, we know the particles that make up the bunny rabbit. Protons, neutrons, electrons, the quarks inside them, and the four forces that hold them together, and the Higgs field filling empty space was the last piece of that puzzle. So on the last slide, I tried to emphasize that physics, particle physics, the search for the ultimate laws of nature, is nowhere near done. We know we have a long way to go. But as far as the fundamental physics underlying us, particle physics is done. We have done it. July 4th, 2012, was when we put the final piece of the puzzle of the matter that you and I are made of together. We've been looking for this for 2,500 years, since Democritus, and we've finally been able to do it. We're not done yet. There are worlds beyond our everyday experience, but this moment in history is not going to be forgotten. 1,000 years from now, we will remember the day that we found the Higgs boson. That is why it is such a big deal.
That was Sean Carroll speaking at the Royal Institution last week about his book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, which is out now. The full video of that lecture will be available at the RI's website later this week. To find out more, go to rigb.org. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.